Hello and welcome to episode 99 of Must See Matches. I am Kieran Money in the Bank Lafort, and joining me, as always, is Mark Monkey in the Bag Buckle D. Mark, how's it going?
I'm good, thanks.
Tremendous. Today we are talking about John Cena versus CM Punk from Money in the Bank, July 17th, 2011, a legit sellout of the Allstate Arena in Rosemont, Illinois, 12,000 people with a gate of $750,000, which I only found out today. And joining us to talk through this, we practically had my arm off when I suggested it, is the godfather of grapple, Gareth Hodgson. Gareth, how you doing?
Oh, I'm great, thanks. Yeah, great to be invited back, and definitely looking forward to talking about this one.
This is our sixth most must-see match, so this is finished number six in all of our polling, with 20.54% of nominations. Without getting too much into the details, Gareth, like, why do you think this one kind of finished so high?
I just think, you know, there's just a lot of different factors. I just think if the one is just how memorable it is. I think for people who were watching it at the time, obviously it was a big thing. But, you know, I think it's, you know, when you think of WWE matches and you think of moments, this one's littered with them, isn't it really? And it's definitely a match that, in my time, when people have said, "What's your favourite match?" You know, it's I've blurted it out before. You know, it's one of those that kind of has that strong, like, emotional appeal. So there's a lot of elements to it, as well as being a bloody good match for what it is as well.
Yeah, I nominated this one myself. I cannot remember what I said about it. Maybe I'll do some digging while we're speaking and try and find that out for the end. Mark, were you watching at this point? Were you watching WWE at this point?
I wasn't watching WWE regularly, but this was smack bang in the middle of my going to WrestleMania run, because I went to Mania in 2008, I went in 2010, I went to the Mania after this in 2012, and then I did 2013, and then I had a break. So I was aware of what was going on. I can't remember if I watched this at the time. I definitely knew the buzz. I definitely was caught up in the buzz. I can't remember if I watched it or not. But yeah, no, it's... I distinctly remember the vibe and the general buzz of the time. I just can't say that I watched it that week.
Yeah, this is pre-network, so this probably would have come from a wrestling torrent site for me. But it was like, it was one of the ones you had to see, I think, like, along with some of the lead up to this. Like, Punk was the talk of the industry at the time. Like, he was, the story is true, his contract legitimately expired on July 17th, 2011, and obviously he signed a new one before this happened, but like, WWE were keeping up the story outside. Like, they were telling everybody, including the writers, including the creative team, no, don't make any plans for him after the 17th. He's done. And he was at that point where, I mean, as he was when he returned to AEW, he could have signed anywhere in the world and been the biggest star in the company. This month is basically the month that made him. This match, effectively, is the match that made him on a mainstream level. I mean, we've talked about him before on this show. This is our third Punk match, right?
Yeah.
Lesnar, one of the Joe matches, which was making him on the indie circuit.
The second Joe versus Punk match.
Yes. And then this is him saying, "I am here. I am a mainstream star."
And it's ironic because it's very much WWE, well, it isn't, it isn't a WWE storyline, but it's told in a WWE way. But in many ways, it's not quite a remake, but it borrows a lot from that ROH Summer of Punk.
Oh yeah.
That vibe of impending leaving and doing what he can to sort of play with the product to his whim, except in this case, he's the face.
He's not. He's only the face in Chicago.
Yeah.
That's the other thing. Like, but this is the big budget remake of the Ring of Honor Summer of Punk, because doesn't he win that belt on his way out the door as well?
Yeah, he does. And the whole storyline is he's still there and they're desperately trying to get the belt off him before it's too late. Whereas when he wins a belt, it is too late.
Yes. Yeah. I guess we could kind of wrap up the stats section. This is our second John Cena match, the other one being the Umaga match from the Royal Rumble 2007, I want to say.
I can't remember if it was 07 or 06.
It's way down the bottom of the spreadsheet. The point is, we talked about John Cena twice, one of which was in our first 10 episodes, and the second time is in our last 10 episodes. So that's quite a disparity between the amount of nominations for those two matches.
The interesting thing is, both guys have a few matches, but neither of them have tons. Neither of them are like top 10 in terms of the most matches nominated. Cena only has 11 and Punk has one more with 12.
So, as is the case when we do big WWE pay-per-view matches, I watched the month of TV leading up to this for one very particular reason, but I was interested to see what else was going on around it. I started on June the 20th, 2011. The Raw episode is called Power to the People, and it's basically Taboo Tuesday, but with text messages. Apparently, they made a right fucking balls up of this. Like, everything was going wrong with the texting system all night. I had to hear so much friggin' Nickelback over the last week because it's the...
Look at you.
Yeah. Oh, Jesus. So Punk comes out to open the show. We are told he beat Ray last night at Capital Punishment. Capital something or other. He sits cross-legged in the middle of the ring, obviously, as usual. And he says, this might be power to the people, but he wouldn't trust any of this crowd with the content of this television program. They will make awful decisions because they chose to live in Baltimore, and thankfully none of their decisions tonight can affect his career. He says he beat Ray at the pay-per-view and Cena last week on Raw, and that makes him the number one contender to the title. He wants an official email from the anonymous Raw general manager, because this is the anonymous Raw general manager era. Oh, I fast-forwarded some shite on these. He wants this email sent to Michael Cole to make it official and confirm that his title match will take place at Money in the Bank in Chicago, and says he's not leaving the ring until this happens. The message duly arrives, but the message tells Punk to leave the ring. Punk protests and makes snow angels on the mat, and then more messages arrive with more emphatic suggestions to leave, and then finally the announcement that all this disrespect means he has to beat Alberto Del Rio tonight to keep his number one contendership. Punk protests this too, saying all Alberto has is one fluke win over the Big Show, so he doesn't deserve to be in the match. And thankfully, a new message announces that it's now a triple threat that also involves Rey Mysterio. In a bit of foreshadowing, Nickelback then plays really loudly, and Punk finds his mic has been cut off when he tries to protest again. I skip through fucking hell. Brie Bella versus Kelly Kelly. Nope. and Evan Bourne versus Mason Ryan.
I mean,
neither of those two in your top 100s now.
I like Matt Sydal, but yeah, Clueless Barry won this one. We get a little recap of the pay-per-view again. Cena beat R-Truth with the help of a kid in the front row. Audible shrug. And then in a segment that goes 10 fucking minutes, they set up Alex Riley, Randy Orton, and John Cena in the main event against Truth, Christian, and Miz. And the fans will choose the stipulation. CM Punk versus Alberto Del Rio versus Rey Mysterio. The people have voted for this to be Falls Count Anywhere. The only concession they make to this is Punk covers Mysterio once on the outside and the rest of the match is entirely in the ring because they clearly had their match worked out. But it's loads of fun. Like, Ray is flying all over the place. It's got a load of good three-way spots in it. The finish, though, is like standard WWE steal the pin bollocks. Ray hits the springboard splash on Bert. Ref gets the two. Punk hurls Ray off into the post and covers Bert to win. And if you kept up with the ref's cadence, Del Rio was down for an 11 count. Punk gets the mic after the match and he says on the 17th, it's going to be a historic day, not just for him, but for WWE as a whole. It's going to be the night he beat Cena for the title. And here comes the brutal honesty he's known for and has got him in trouble many times. It's the day his contract expires. That means when the clock strikes midnight, when the 17th becomes the 18th and Sunday bleeds into Monday, I'm leaving. And trust me when I tell you, I'm leaving with the WWE Championship. And then there's a shitty elimination match in the main event that John Cena wins. Can't be bothered going through all of that shit. Neither that nor the Vicky Guerrero versus Michael Cole dance contest.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Oh, boy. Outside of the punk and Cena stuff, this is bad. Here's a match for you.
I think all how bad this is, though, it all bleeds into the importance of obviously what we're going to get to and what we're going to discuss. And you almost have to take that pain to almost get the feeling of the time, don't you?
Yeah, it's like, everything else going on is exactly the stuff that Punk is railing against.
Also, wasn't like a month or two before this, he was still technically involved with a new Nexus.
He is still here, the leader of the Nexus. If you notice his name graphic, when he comes out for the Money in the Bank match, it still says the Nexus on it. June 27th is Raw Roulette, which seems to mean a load of rematches from last week, but with the stipulations they actually wanted the fans to choose. Shawn Michaels is out to open. He takes 5 minutes to plug his hunting show on whatever shit cable channel it was on. Punk interrupts. He is with the tag team champions. Would either of you like to guess who the tag team champions were at this point?
Is it Heath Slater and Justin Gabriel?
That's one answer.
Don't know. Lance Cade and Trevor Murdoch.
Oh, both very good and both in the right ballpark. David Otunga and Michael McGillicuddy.
Yeah.
Yep. Punk mocks Sean for not being able to stay away from the spotlight and reiterates that he'll be leaving in a couple of weeks and he couldn't be happier about it. He says, Michaels went out like a loser, unable to beat The Undertaker in his last match. Wow, those two had their last match together, eh? But Punk will go out a winner, taking the title with him. He says it's sad the crowd would rather get on their feet and put their hands together to welcome the past in Shawn Michaels than get on their hands and knees and beg the future to stay. What a great line.
Awesome.
Michael says they're nothing alike despite a few similarities. They don't smoke, drink or do drugs. And Punk, with a big grin on his face, yells, "Anymore!" Sean says, fair enough, but at the end of the day, you've got your style and I've got mine, and KO's Otunga with the super kick. So your tag team champion looks like an utter goon.
I mean, it's David Otunga. You can't look more than a goon than the base level.
Yes, I know. So the Raw GM thing goes ding, saying that Punk only has three Raws left, so they're going to be made to count. He's going to be in the opener. Backstage, Booker T, in a clearly pre-taped segment, spins the wheel to decide the stipulation, which lands on a question mark. He explains this means it's a mystery opponent who is helpfully standing just off camera and, of course, is Kane. And then just to make the tag team champions look brilliant, Sean superkicks McGillicuddy, tells Punk good luck with all that Kane shit and bails. CM Punk versus Kane, because the title contender always has to beat a giant gatekeeper in the run-up to get their shot in WWE. And just as I wrote that, Punk walks out and gets counted out. Way to build your number one contender. Apparently a bloke called Andy Levine won Tough Enough a month ago. Here he is training in FCW. He would quickly be renamed Kevin Hackman, never have a main roster match, do 2 years in Puerto Rico and retire. Yes. This wasn't the only Andy update we got over the course of these Raws. Like, they put money into him and it did not pay off. Your main event is John Cena versus R-Truth in a table match. Not an interesting match at all until Punk arrives in a Steve Austin t-shirt to move a table out the path of an AA, saving Truth. He and Cena brawl, and as they get into the ring, Truth spears Cena through a table in the corner to win. If we're keeping track, that means both the champion and number one contender have lost on the same show. Punk gets hold of a microphone, heads up to the stage, sits down cross-legged. It is, in fact, the pipe bomb promo. And I'm not going to recite it, but it's a classic for a reason. Mm. It is a blurring of the lines. It's fueled by real feelings. And it's so, so different in 2011 WWE. They'd never gone this well. For the closest they'd gone with, like, work shoot stuff was, I don't know, like, Brett screaming, this is bullshit, at Vince after losing a cage match to Sid and that kind of stuff. This was electric at the time. But as Mark likes to say, it's one of the big things in wrestling that people took all the wrong lessons from and has been weakly imitated so many times since. Mm. So he talks for about 5 minutes and eventually the mic is cut just as he's about to tell a personal story about Vince McMahon, and then he's yelling into the camera about being silenced, and they abruptly cut to black and the show is over. He does all the things you're not allowed to do in WWE. Talks to the camera, calls himself a wrestler, mentions other companies, in this case New Japan and Ring of Honor, shouts out his buddy they fired, apparently sheds light on what goes on backstage. He insults The Rock, Stephanie and Triple H. But the genius of it is nothing, absolutely nothing in it breaks kayfabe. And it's all the logical opinion of the character of CM Punk. This isn't Phil Brooks complaining about how he's being booked. CM Punk complains about how he's being promoted.
And that's probably the details that people forget and probably don't remember. It's people remember the contract, remember this. They're conflating it with what happened two, three years later. I mean, it said something to me. I was shocked that he came out to Killswitch Engage because I forgot In Living Colour was when he came back.
That was one of the legitimate points in his contract was you will license this song for me. Yeah, it's interesting. Like this promo, I think, has lost a lot of its power because I think simply because it got imitated a lot. In the same way as we'll see in the match, like they tried to redo Montreal and like killed all the power of that over the years. But like, yeah, at this time, this was all any wrestling fan was talking about, like CM Punk, quote unquote, shot on WWE without actually doing any shooting at all.
Yeah, and I think, like you say, it's that blurring the lines between reality and kayfabe that's just done so well. And then also just, I think, blurring the lines with the fan base as well. And the fact that a lot of what he's talking about, okay, he's talking about in a kayfabe way here, but he's talking about a lot of the same things or sort of giving a nod towards a lot of things that people are talking about on message boards for years before that were disgruntled about and everything like that. So he's, you know, obviously he carries the whole voice of the voiceless line and things like that, but you know, it very much did feel like here he is at this point carrying the voice of a million disgruntled fans who are out there who want something different. And again, I think that's the genius of it is the way that it transcends so many elements but still manages to work in a WWE TV land way.
And also think about the timing. I don't know if we were already in it, but this is around the period where you're getting that disgruntled crowd that will go off on one. We're like the year after this is when Brock Lesnar came back at the Raw after Mania. It was just before or just around those Raw after Manias where the crowds just completely derailed everything. This is kind of, it almost, I don't know if it was going on before this happened or if this was the catalyst to embolden the fans to do it, but it's at the period where the WWE live fan base was most willing to go against what the product was telling them. And so the timing for that is perfect. Now, as I said, was this the catalyst or was it already ongoing and they just jumped on it? I can't remember.
Great answer to that sentence. Thanks, man. The July the 4th Raw is taped immediately after this one as the whole crew was on tour in Australia, where Punk almost fucked the whole thing up by calling a member of the Adelaide crowd a homophobic slur over the house mic. It got on YouTube and GLAAD called them onto the carpet for something like the third time that year. And they basically bullshitted GLAAD and said, no, we don't condone this, but he's gone on the 17th anyway. Doesn't matter.
And he's probably already re-signed at this point.
Yeah. This feels like a pre-tape from moment one. A musical recap of last week's main event and most of the promo. Michael Cole tells us CM Punk is indefinitely suspended, so we need a new number one contender. There will be a Rey versus Alberto versus R-Truth match to fill that gap. Burt beats Rey in a match I skipped through, and they still manage to do a steal the pin finish in a three-way, but with a submission hold. They have one finish for three-way matches. John Cena comes out. He confirms that Punk is suspended for what he said last week. And because he's John Cena, he plays the GCSC Humanities debate card of, I don't agree with what he said, but I fight for his right to say it. Asking where management censorship stops. He brings up Bryan Danielson being fired for being too aggressive, which I thought was interesting. And this one cracked me up. There's been speculation that at certain events, WWE representatives confiscate the signs that you make. And he says, what has really happened is that Punk has been suspended for speaking his mind. He says he wants answers from the mouth of the man who made the decision, Vincent Kennedy McMahon, and promises that Vince is on his way to the building and any conversation they have will happen in the ring in front of the fans. And he finishes by saying he wants to face Punk at Money in the Bank. Jack Swagger versus a 100-year-old Sergeant Sorter. Skip. So your main event segment is Vince and Cena in the ring. Vince says Punk was suspended because he deserved it. Thank you very much. We'll see you next week in Boston. Goes to leave. Feel free to boo, swear at, and throw rotten cabbages at Vince McMahon at any point during this show. Cena gasses Vince up, saying he used to be a fighter, but suspended Punk for speaking his mind was a coward move. If Vince doesn't want to fight anymore, Cena still does, and maybe it's time for the old man to give it up. Vince says the real reason he suspended Punk was he saw Punk beat Cena a few weeks ago and didn't want to take the risk that it would happen again in Chicago on Punk's last night in the company and have Punk, quote, walk into some other wrestling company with my belt. John goes on a tear, saying from his perspective, Money in the Bank is the biggest show of the year because of the intrigue of what if Punk does win? How will John Cena handle a hostile crowd? Will the kid that rode the side of his car at WrestleMania 22 grow a set and do something crazy? Vince reminds Cena that WWE is his company and basically calls him replaceable, saying the likes of Hogan, Austin, and Michaels were all champions and they've all come and gone. Cena says Vince is so worried about Punk taking the belt and make it meaningless, but Punk suspending Punk and denying him the title match he has earned has already made it meaningless, and he hands the belt to Vince and leaves. McMahon yells at him, calls him an ingrate, asks if he's going to walk out like all the others did, and then gets him to stop at the top of the ramp. We very obviously cut around Vince making a hash of getting out of the ring with the belt. And this conference concludes on the stage where he reinstates Punk and says the match is on. But Cena has no reason to smile about it, because if CM Punk walks out of Money in the Bank as champion, Cena is fired. That took 13 minutes of television. Yeah.
At least I would say, though, as well at this time, it's kind of one of those instances where sometimes WWE is good at tying up little loose ends. And, you know, there is that kind of like logic gap where you could be like, well, why would they do this match? And you know, they've thought about it and taken a step back and thought, okay, how does this work from John Cena's perspective? How does this work from the company's perspective? Yes. And, you know, how can we kind of make that meet in the middle so that it's credible that the match would actually happen, and it's, you know, it's puts almost like an element or shade of doubt in there as well, really. So I think that was something that they did do well in the run up to this, because without that, it potentially could have been just taken a little edge off it or something like that, and made it just feel a bit, why is this even happening? You know.
Yeah, I mean, as I was watching through this stuff, I kept thinking, "Oh Jesus, they've screwed it!" Like, you know, they've not thought this through. And then, like, the next minute it would turn out they had thought this through. They had made logical sense of what these characters would think, how these characters react in a situation, why it still made sense for the match to take place.
And how many episodes have we done on WWF where the build has been absolutely dreadful and it's just not worked and it's not clicked? And
not as many as TNA. So your go-home Raw is July the 11th in Boston. Show opens with CM Punk coming out with a megaphone and, unfortunately, a moustache. Do I have everybody's attention now? He recaps the promo, the suspension, the reinstatement, and the title match being back on, and announces through the megaphone that he brought back up in case his mic gets switched off again. He plays with the siren on it as the place chants his name, and anybody who was booing for him when he came out, and there were plenty, are now on his side. He explains he's in the ring with a live mic because Vince is currently bending over backwards, giving him everything he wants to try to get him to re-sign. See, that's another detail covered. This is why this man who spoke out is being allowed to do so again. He says all he ever really wanted is the microphone, and he points to it. He says, this is power. In anybody else's hands, this is just a microphone. In my hands, it's a pipe bomb. If Vince had treated him this nice 5 years ago, he wouldn't have 5 years of ammunition to unload on him, and he wouldn't have this much to say. He challenges Vince to come and do the contract negotiation tonight in the ring. Cena's music hits, he comes out, and through the megaphone, you can hear Punk saying, sir, I'm talking here. Sir, I'm afraid your music is just too loud. Punk thanks him for getting reinstated to a job he didn't really want in the first place, and gets a huge pop for saying when he beats Cena on Sunday, he's going to change the design of the belt because that thing has been far too ugly for far too long. This is spinner belt era for anybody who's not caught up. He reminds us of the firing stip, shitting on a previous John Cena gets fired stip by saying that that only lasted a week, so Cena doesn't really need to worry about it. Cena says, for 3 weeks, Punk has been acting like it doesn't matter who he faces. It's a foregone conclusion that he's winning the belt in Chicago and walking out, but Punk has to go through him and he's no pushover. He says, while he was half knocked out after going through the table, he heard Punk claim to be the best wrestler. And he says, well, he's the best because he holds the title and he earned it. And he reels off a bunch of names, Triple H, JBL, Edge, Batista, Randy Orton, Kurt Angle, who was then in TNA, and even Eddie Guerrero. They all thought there's no way Cena could hang with them, and every single one of them ended up disappointed. He then sells a load of pay-per-views by saying, I don't care if you've got a mic or a megaphone. I don't care if you stay or if you go. I don't care if Vince McMahon fires me or if he's full of it. I think I'm coming to Chicago and Money in the Bank to whip your ass. The stupid Raw GM noise dings. We're told that Vince is en route to negotiate with Punk and that Cena will have to wrestle, quote, a very special match next. Oh, Christ, that usually means the big show. Punk backs off up the aisle, wishing Cena luck over the megaphone as we go to commercial. And when we come back, the first thing you hear out of Cena is, what's it going to be, a lingerie pillow fight? It is, in fact, a handicap match versus the tag team champions. And because it's WWE in 2011, you know exactly how this one goes. Cena beats the tag champions by himself. And then less than an hour later on the same show, they do a second handicap match of Drew McIntyre and Dolph Ziggler versus the Big Show. The Punk contract negotiation. Let's try and rip through this. Table, office chairs, clipboards, you know the deal. Vince does his entrance four times, trying to get a bigger pop each time, and the show must have been running short. He complains about having to do all this in public. Punk comes out, and in a genuinely funny moment, Vince goes to sit down and the chair is at its minimum height, so he practically hits his chin on the table. Vince mocks the provisions that Punk has asked for in the contract and says they're doing this because he couldn't live with himself if Punk actually won the title on the last day of his existing deal, and walks out. Punk says his lawyers looked over the contract Vince offers, decided it wasn't up to par, and drew up a new one. And he's already signed it. All that needs to happen is Vince needs to sign it as well. And he lists off some of the added perks. He gets to push Vince, and does. He gets a jet, not Vince's, because that one smells. He wants his own. He wants his face on everything, including, yes, the return of the ice cream bars. This gets the biggest pop of the whole show. He wants CM Punk the movie, which they can call The Chaperone 2, only this one will be funny and successful. And whatever match he is in at WrestleMania will be the main event, even if John Cena versus Rock is still going ahead. Remember, we're in the middle of Twice in a Lifetime. Mm. And the most important point is Vince has to apologize to him and to the crowd. He hauls Vince over the coals for firing Colt Cabana and Luke Gallows. Jesus, I didn't expect to be saying that name today. basically calls him out of touch and tells him he punishes people for liking professional wrestling. And this is where he coins the voice of the voiceless phrase. Vince, of course, dodges, apologizing. The crowd chant, "We want ice cream." And Vince yells at them, "I don't give a damn what you want." And which Punk retorts, "That's the problem." Nice. Vince eventually apologizes. The crowd alternately chant Colt Cabana and "We Want Ice Cream" as Vince struggles to get the pen out of the folder, and him clicking the end of it apparently activates John Cena's music, and out he comes. He says Punk's new contract is full of ridiculous demands that he knows Vince can't meet, because what he really wants is just take the belt and leave. Punk's retort is that Cena threw out a list of names earlier who claimed that Cena couldn't hang with them, but that's exactly what Cena is doing now, being the big shot who thinks Punk can't hang with him. He says he hung off the side of Cena's entrance car at WrestleMania 22, watched the match from ringside with a fake Tommy gun in his hands, and told himself that eventually he wouldn't be next to the ring, he'd be in the ring watching John Cena go down to CM Punk. Punk makes a load of local sports references here in Cena's hometown, saying Cena still thinks he's the underdog despite being the 10-time champion. But just like insert names of Boston sports teams here, he's really become what he hates. He's not the Boston Red Sox. He's the New York Yankees. For a non-American who is not into whatever was going on in US sports 13 years ago, this being what makes Cena deck him seems like an overreaction.
He doesn't like it at all, does he, Cena? He's furious at that line, isn't he?
Yeah. Punk bails, grabs the contract back off Vince and heads up to the stage. He commands Cena's mic be shut off when it starts up because he has one more thing to say. He's glad Cena punched him because it hit him like a bolt of lightning why he wants to leave. He's tired of this. He's tired of Cena. And on Sunday, everyone could say goodbye to the title, goodbye to John Cena, and goodbye to CM Punk. And he tears up the contract and says, "I will go and be the best in the world somewhere else." So you still have that doubt in your mind as to what is going to happen if he wins. Combined on this two-hour show, CM Punk, John Cena, and Vince McMahon talked for 55-0 minutes. Holy shit.
But I mean, if the alternative is two handicap matches that probably went 3 minutes each.
There were a lot of Kelly matches, let me tell you. So we come to the show. The match is sponsored by Skittles, because why not? The hype video is mostly from the Boston stuff. Mm. I really love the sweeping crane shot over the crowd in the upper deck, showing just how packed that building was. And that's not normally a place they would put a crane to do that kind of thing. You kind of hit on it earlier, Mark. My memory is always that Punk comes out to Cult of Personality, and he certainly doesn't have the Nexus in his lower third graphic. But neither of those things are true, obviously. I also forget that this match is called by Michael Cole, Jerry Lawler, and Booker T. My next note is, for fuck's sake. I had a look in the Observer. Those three, not quite in that order, were numbers 1, 2, and 3 for worst commentator of the year.
I get it. There's some choice lines of, well, you obviously had that teed up because 20 seconds earlier completely destroyed the point you're trying to make.
Yes. A big hand to the guy who loves Brutus Beefcake so much he spelled Brutus wrong on his sign.
Yep, Brutus.
Yep. And also big hand to the director for cutting to Punk just as he screams, "It's my fucking time!" the moustache is gone, thankfully. I honestly think the boo for John Cena is bigger than the pop for Punk. It was so loud, all I could do was laugh. They hated him.
What I loved before this is where Punk's just sat cross-legged, smiling, and then he's like, "No, fuck it, I need you guys louder," and pops them again. And that crowd is constantly, constantly going, constantly moving.
We've talked many times about a crowd that is up for it. Yeah. From the get-go, this is absolutely one of those.
And it's such a key component in this match, isn't it? The crowd, obviously you get into that, but just the rabid nature of this crowd. It was like a crowd reaction that you hadn't heard, or you felt like you hadn't heard for years, really, the reaction that's coming out of it. And then when you talk about the boos for Cena, I've got to give Cena credit here, just for sort of the stoic way he walks to the ring, the change in his whole entrance and the way he carries himself and everything.
No pandering at all.
No salute, no stuff with the cum rag on the stage, no posing, no let's go to work, no getting Stu the cameraman to run with him. Like, as has become an AEW commentary cliche, his jaw is set as he walks just straight out to the ring. He even keeps his head down as he raises the belt over his head.
Yeah.
It's quite similar to the Rob Van Dam match in Hammerstein. Like, John Cena in a hostile environment is frequently where he's at his best. He really knows how to work that.
One of the bits in this bit when he's in the ring is he does this, and he does it a couple of times, he does this shadow boxing to try and get himself focused and try and get his head in the game. And I love this, I love how he uses it, and it's then a callback like in the final stretch.
He's not here to fuck about, he's here to fight.
Also, referee Scott Armstrong, who I believe has wrestled more matches than Brock Lesnar in his career, in their careers.
Wait, which Armstrong is it Steve? Which one was in the Young Pistols? That's Steve, isn't it?
That's Steve.
I was just thinking that the referee had also been in a must-see match, but it's not, it's a different one. Yeah. I had to chuckle at the cameraman told to get a shot of CM Punk on the outside, but try to frame out Colt Cabana and Ace Steel, who are right behind him in the front row.
It's a great shot, though, of Punk that they're just clapping away at Cena again, sort of sarcastically, as Cena's in ring. Just again, this is before the match has even started. There's just so many different small detailed elements that they've added to this as a spectacle and as a match before we've even, like, you know, before the bell's even rung, really. It just shows the level of thought and detail that's gone into this that, you know, contributes to making it so good.
It's one of the things to remember. Punk is still technically a heel. He just happens to be in his hometown. Mm. After the bell, they do some of the most basic chain wrestling until Punk backs Cena into the ropes and misses with a head kick at the break. Punk is confused by the "you can't wrestle" chant and is very relieved when he finds out it's for Cena and not him. More wrestle, and then Cena runs over Punk with a shoulder tackle. On commentary, Jerry Lawler makes a right fucking hash of this. He says he doesn't understand why the fans are behind CM Punk wanting to leave, presupposing their only loyalty is to WWE and not to any individual performer. He doesn't understand why Chicago is behind wanting Punk to leave because they'll never see him again. He lives there. They'll fucking run into him walking his ugly little dog or buying donuts. And he doesn't understand why Punk wants to leave because then he'll be unemployed, presupposing that Punk isn't well paid here and hasn't saved any money.
take great joy that later on Lawler throws a proper strop when Michael Cole says, "Oh, were you never WWF champion?"
Yes.
Proper strop.
Yeah, Booker T's trying to make the point that he's won a lot of titles. You know, he was a 5-time world heavyweight champion, but the WWE title is so hard to win that he never managed it. And Cole is like, "You didn't either, did you, King?" Cole rewrites history, bringing up Survivor Series 1997 and saying Vince screwed Bret Hart on that night because Bret wanted to leave and take the title to WCW. And those are the lengths Vince will go to keep the belt in his company. Punk does You Can't See Me, and they both tease their Lift You Up Onto My Shoulders finishes.
Yeah.
Punk baits Cena for a test of strength, but drops him with kicks to the legs before they even touch. Cena reverses the corner whip. Punk does the Bret turnbuckle bump and gets bulldogged, face locked, and then almost has his head taken off with, I think, the stiffest, snappiest clothesline I might have ever seen out of John Cena.
It's a proper clothesline.
Yeah. Punk sells it like he got a bicep in the mouth as well, which also helps. Punk back suplexes out of a long headlock, and now it's Cena's turn to take the Bret bump. It's not the full John Cena banana shape bump, but it hits the button in his chest that switches off only his legs, and he hits the corner and goes straight down. I really noticed, like, watching a bunch of Cena matches in the run-up, he has a particular bump where he kind of curves like a banana and drops on his side. He does it later on.
To be fair, I think he took the front buckle better than Punk did, yeah. Definitely. You know, given that Punk's the big Bret guy, you'd have thought he'd have been putting stacks of effort in to try to make that as look as good as it could. But it looked pretty light, actually.
It's not the first time you're going to say Cena did something better than Punk in this match.
Cena comes back with his release cradle suplex that I refuse to call a fisherman suplex, and teases the AA, but Punk slips out and gets a two count off a DDT. Cole sums up how stupid WWE is in one line by saying CM Punk is a 3-time world heavyweight champion, but he's never won the WWE title. Yeah. Just have one top belt.
Yeah.
Punk has Cena in a figure four head scissors, and the reversal does not get enough credit. Cena rolls to his front, gets his knees under him, and like it's nothing, just stands up with CM Punk on his shoulders.
Yeah.
Other than putting his hands down so he doesn't rub his face along the mat, it didn't look like Punk helped him at all. He's absurdly strong.
And there's an awful lot of headlocks and basic holds for a John Cena match in this one.
But he can't wrestle. Punk elbows his way out, and we head outside where Punk slaps hands with, quote, a fan, who is Colt Cabana, and drops a knee across the back of a draped Cena's neck from the middle rope. Back inside, Cena dodges a corner charge, sending Punk into the post. But Punk, kicking off the STF attempt, activates the banana bump, and he gets a two off a clothesline. I'm never going to be able to unsee it now. WWE main event, so chinlock, but here it makes sense because Punk has been softening up the neck already. We get the high-pitched Let's Go Cena versus the basier Cena sucks chance. As Punk somehow hits Cena in the knee. He hits Cena in the knee with a twisting crossbody off the top row.
It's incredible. It's almost like a safer version of the Undertaker dive against Michaels in terms of how quickly he loses height. Gravity got turned on.
I mean, it's like when we talked about that, we said, like, basically it was the most perfect he's ever done that dive, except the guy he needed to land on was one step further away than he should have been. And that was exactly the same here. Like, this looks so good until one moment, as you said, where someone hits the gravity off switch and Punk just plummets.
It was proper Wile E. Coyote stuff, this one. With that one. But I think Punk talks about that himself, about, like, the, I don't know, sometimes the athleticism letting him down sometimes. And I think this is definitely...
Has Punk been reading my notes?
Cena does look legitimately worried about his knee for a minute. and goes over to the apron and kind of tests it out. But he quickly gets his revenge by suplexing Punk over the top to the floor, and it is a lumpy bump with a loud thud.
Cena does a few suplexes, and he doesn't know what to do with his legs on a suplex. They're just everywhere.
Yeah. Back inside, the cradle suplex again and an elbow drop, but there is no way this is ending on an elbow drop. Punk fights out of a couple of AA attempts, but takes whatever John Cena's version of an Emerald Flosion is. They do Booyah strikes, culminating in Cena hooking an absolute dog of an abdominal stretch. I think only his left arm is really where it should be in this thing. A Punk very easily could have just taken like one step and got out of it. Punk goes to the eyes to escape because he's a heel, and we double down off simultaneous clotheslines. When they get back up, Cena goes into the flying shoulder block routine, but Punk flips out of the blue thunder part and grabs a near fall off a roll up.
And doesn't he make a dog of this flip over?
They're not athletic men. Like these guys are the storytellers. You know, this isn't Rey Mysterio Jr. versus Psicosis. This is not Bryan Danielson versus Hechicero. This is CM Punk versus John Cena.
I'll stick up for it here and say that this makes it look more of a fight. The fact that it is a bit clunky kind of thing in parts, and I know it's supposed to look smooth and it should look better than it does, but I think these elements, sometimes can add as well in making it look more of a fight, more of a struggle sometimes, even when it is just a fuck up.
I get that, but I wouldn't make as much fun out of this if it wasn't for the fact it looks like Punk nearly wipes himself out landing on his head.
That's true.
It's not like, on the knees. It looks like he took more damage than if Cena had hit the protoplex in the first place.
Punk misses a rising knee strike in the corner, runs into the Blue Thunder, and Cena can't help himself. He shrugs to the crowd because he knows he has to do You Can't See Me and the Five Knuckle Shuffle. But he takes too long, and Punk boots him in the head, shoves him outside, and hits a tope. Back inside again, Cena avoids a springboard clothesline, does the You Can't See Me chant, Five Knuckle Shuffle mat punch, and gets Punk up for the AA. Punk flips out onto his feet and immediately onto his ass because the C doesn't stand for coordinated, and comes back with some kicks and quite a nice leg sweep, I thought, for a near fall. Like it was the down and low kick from Mortal Kombat. Yeah.
One of my favourite things from Punk up to this point is his reaction when he sees the opportunity for the tope. It's that look of joy and yes, here we go. And I'm glad that they caught that expression when they did the replay as well.
We were moments away when he did that. You get the close-up of the face. We were moments away from my favourite version of CM Punk. So here he has the hair that is slicked back and clamped down to his head. And there would often be points in his matches where just one side would give up and spring out and he'd look like a newborn chick. And newborn chick CM Punk was always my favourite. Cena turns go to sleep into a gut wrench for his own near fall. But Punk escapes another AA attempt and hits a rising knee in the ropes. The second one smashes Cena right in the mouth, and we get a few lovely slow motion replays of Cena getting rocked by this thing. He was lucky not to lose a tooth. Like, I was surprised there was no blood or a broken nose. He got walloped.
He kind of been happy this match is like, because his knee definitely had hurt his knee, hadn't he, earlier?
Yeah.
And he gets walloped in the mouth here.
Yeah.
He's a sore boy in the back here. You know, he's thinking, you can tell he's thinking, like, hang about, is this a good idea? This route should be going down here because it's not working out for me tonight.
I'm glad this prick's leaving. Bulldog, springboard lariat, but Cena kicks out. Cena absorbs some mid kicks, but ducks a big swinging one to the head, takes out Punk's knee, and clamps on the STF. Big pop for filmmaking to the ropes. He then holds the ropes to stop Cena pulling him back into the middle of the ring and turns and snaps off a kick to the temple for a near fall. Punk has a top rope crossbody, but because John Cena is just a muscle in denim shorts, he catches him, rolls through, hoists him up onto the shoulders for the AA. Once again, Punk escapes, gets Cena up for the GTS, but Cena counters by getting hold of the knee as it comes up, sweeping Punk to the mat and getting the SDF on again. I love how the crowd get louder and louder as this spot escalates. It's a brilliant piece of work.
It's probably the smoothest and one of the best work sequences in the entire match. Mm. And while I don't like how Cena clamps on the STF with his arms, what I loved repeatedly is how he sets the STF up, because it's so visually dynamic.
But what's going to hurt more if you're John Cena? Like, look at the size of those forearms. It's not the traditional grip, but like, imagine having those pressed against your temples.
I mean, I get that. It's just, it always looks like it.
It's the old Paul Heyman thing. I would give Mark Henry the headlock as a finisher because you'd fucking submit if Mark Henry put you in a headlock.
Okay, it sounds weird. Mm. Imagine John Cena doing a Fujiwara armbar.
He does earlier in the match.
Yeah, but imagine if he did that as the finish instead of the STFU. He's like a man with massive arms just trying to rip your arm off.
Yeah, fine. Fair enough. Fair enough.
He's got to have technique, though.
Yeah, it's also that might actually.
I mean,
better
he has decent technique when he applies it. I think it's a better. I personally think if I'd go back and say fuck off with the STF, do a Fujiwara armbar, you're set, mate.
At this point in the match, though, something that I just really like is just them. I mean, obviously, you're into the STFU here, but the setup counters that they've done here with AAs and GTSs throughout this match as well. So, you know, just building the crowd, you know, just waiting for that one to pop, and then the expectation probably that Cena hits the AA, that's it, it's done and it's over, or vice versa, the counter's there for Punk to hit the GTS and something come from it there as well. So I just think the way that they've worked that into the match, this is maybe the third point or something like that, where there's been a couple of missed attempts or something like that. I think that's just a nice little thread that they've got running through this coming to the end there. The fact that it's not just been something that's people are waiting for a finisher like at the end of the match. It's something that they went for pretty much immediately in the match, and then they've sort of like dotted throughout. It's a big part to making the finish even better for me, I think, when we get there.
Mm. This is the part of the match where wherever you look, you can't see anybody sitting down, and they would all stay standing up until the end of the match. These people are going ballistic as Cena releases the hold, drags Punk back to the middle and reapplies.
Yeah.
They find another gear as Punk teases tapping out and then thinks, no, I can't. Mm. Gets an arm free and rolls it over into the Anaconda Vice, which Cole expertly calls submission maneuver. Despite him having done it many, many times in the company beforehand.
And earlier in the match, he called an Anaconda Vice on nothing.
Yes, I know. Cena struggles up to his feet, finally gets the AA, but he's a bit slow to get over for the cover, and Punk dramatically kicks out on a late two count. Cena goes for the old little Guido Sicilian slice off the top, but Punk turns it into a powerbomb for his own near fall. Punk signals for the GTS, but Cena grabs the ropes from his shoulders, pulls himself out to the apron and snaps Punk's neck over the top rope.
Love that.
Yeah.
Love that. Fantastic. It's the face showing, fuck it, I need to win this.
Yes. It's not a dirty tactic, but it's like, it's the unsportsmanlike babyface we've talked about before.
Yeah.
Like going as close as he'll get to like effectively breaking the rules. You know, it's not nice to pull someone's throat on the top rope, but he didn't kick him in the bollocks and he didn't poke him in the eye. Like that kind of thing. It's technically, it's still legal. Coming back in, he gets the slice, but again, Punk kicks out. I really like that he stayed out of Punk's eyeline, stalking him from behind, but not in a theatrical pro wrestling way. It really seemed like a tactical decision.
Yeah.
Gets hold of him, hits the AA, this time covers immediately, but Punk still kicks out.
Yeah. I want to point something out here. It's one of my favorite things about the match. It's John Cena's reactions every time he goes for a move and it isn't the finish. Mm-hmm. He is so good with his expressions and his character work and just slowly getting rattled and like getting frustrated, and it builds and builds. And at one point, I think he remonstrates with a referee and goes through all five stages of grief in about 15 seconds. And it's like, for a match that is remembered for Punk and the vibe and the feeling and that, Cena's so good at these kind of moments of doing what makes sense for his character logically, because at the end of the day, Cena's career's on the line. Mm. He's having to focus through this. And I think he does a fantastic job.
Yeah, oh yeah. So this is remembered, as you said, this remembers being the CM Punk show, but this is just as good a John Cena performance as it is a CM Punk performance. Mm-hmm. Like, 100%. If John Cena goes out there and acts like he doesn't give a shit, like, this is nowhere near as good as it is.
Yeah.
And it would not be remembered the way it is.
And I think, like you say there, Mark, as well, is that sort of the flustered nature he goes to the ref at here, and it not been, you know, John Cena has that tendency to be over the top and hokey at times kind of thing, and it's not here kind of thing.
Yeah.
It does feel like it's more genuine in the moment as well. Mm. And again, it's just adding something else.
Yeah. And when I was talking about it, you're right, he's not being hokey. It's understated, but you can get it. People watching and the fact they're doing these constant close-ups of Cena, they're doing everything they can to make you get it without Cena going all ham.
Yeah, he's not screaming at the ref. He's not shaking the ref. He's just asking him, are you sure that wasn't three? Are you absolutely sure it wasn't three? He decides what will be three, though, is a super AA off the top. But Punk elbows and elbows and elbows his way out and then takes Cena down with a top rope Frankensteiner. Punk hits the rising knee in the corner and finally the GTS, but it sends Cena to the floor and a despairing Punk like flops outside after him. Like the look on his face, he grabs hold of the apron rather than the apron skirt rather than Cena. He goes outside to get him back in, as here is where you throw your cabbages. Vince McMahon and co-defendant John Laurinaitis come out. Punk takes too much time looking at them before getting back in and ends up in a surprise STF. Vince motions for the bell to be rung, and when it isn't, he sends Ace over to do it. Cena sees him coming, relinquishes the hold, slides out, and absolutely nails him with a forearm. Mm. Apparently, he proper potatoed him, and people around the monitor in the back were cheering. he tells Laurinaitis and then Vince that he's not going to win this match that way, and slides back into the ring, straight into the GTS, and straight into the three count. Then quickly, the bit everybody always forgets. Vince goes over to the commentary desk, takes King's headset and orders Alberto Del Rio, who won the Raw Money in the Bank that night, to come out and cash in. Del Rio sprints to the ring right into a head kick and goes straight down. No cash in here. and then back to the bit you do remember, which is Punk climbing on the barrier, blowing Vince a kiss and absconding into the crowd on the Chicago night air with the title.
Quick shout out to Scott Armstrong, who after he counts a three, he's in the aisle with Vince, and the look of absolute fear on his face makes you wonder whether it was shoot or not.
Yeah, if Cena's getting fired, I probably am too.
I think credit to Michael Cole. He has a great line as well, whereas this Punk holds the belt after the pin, and he has that in 1 hour and 14 minutes. CM Punk is no longer an employee of WWE, and it just adds to the chaos of the moment or something like that. Which, you know, it's rare that I'm going to probably call a great line from Michael Cole during this time period, but I think that's really one that just sort of stands out and just sort of, again, really cements and reaffirms that point.
It's a great line? Because Vince is right in front of him as he says it, so he's not yelling in his ear.
Very true.
Yeah. We also have to remember, this is in the middle of Michael Cole, heel lead announcer, which was horrific. But although he is a heel, he is screaming for John Cena to win at points in this match. Like, desperate for Punk to tap out to the STF. Desperate for Cena to get the pin with the AA. I am going to go to Gareth first. Must see?
100% must see. It's must see every year of your life till the end of time kind of thing. It's one of those matches that I just go back to. And again, I've watched it a couple of times in the run-up to recording to tonight. And it's just the crowd, the moment at the end, it's goosebumps. I've got goosebumps now just thinking about it, you know, down my spine. Just really one of those where my brain just transports to just being in that moment and feeling that crowd at that time, feeling that reaction at the end of it. And it's very much kind of happy place territory for me this one.
Mark, how about you?
I'm going to date this slightly, although not in a way that anyone will notice. This weekend, Trevor Dame of the Through the Years podcast made an analogy describing WWE style story as being a source. Like, like the idea that the match is the key ingredient, and a great match, you don't need a sauce, but if the match isn't good, the sauce improves it. And yeah, I think this match helps from the sauce, which is the context, the story, the element of Punk leaving. I think it's an example where without it, I think this match is much, much less.
Mm.
But also to stretch that food analogy even further, this match is about the ambience. This match is about the crowd. It's about the vibe. It's about that feel that you remember. Sometimes if I have a meal that I had as a kid, it kind of gives me a sense of nostalgia.
Mm-hmm.
And you really get that here. You kind of watching this for the first time, I'm remembering that buzz that I felt back then when people were like, oh shit, is this legit?
Mm.
You know, when that pipe bomb promo happened, and then when this happened, that sense of excitement, and it kind of brings me back.
Mm.
So this match is one of those few that will, it literally warps you back in time. It brings those memories back up.
I think it's an interesting one as well, because we're sort of both alluding to that there, and then with your analogy there about the sauce, Mark, it was one of the things I was thinking about, and it is, if, I don't know, some guy who's 17-year-old threw this on and watched it now, are they going to think you're insane for thinking it's a must-see match? Because in isolation, it's hard for me to even think about it or watch it and apply that logic to my brain, because I've got so many different emotions and feelings and recall going back. And I think it probably can't have that same level for somebody like us who were there and living that at the time and experiencing it.
I think it's one of those matches where if you weren't there, it probably has less of an impact. Whereas we've had a lot of matches on this podcast where you can 100% parachute into it and you get it.
Even with the hype video, as I mentioned, like almost all of that is from the go home show, like not the part you would think they should actually show to build this up, like the other legendary part of this month.
Because they don't do any lines from that, do they?
There's a couple of little flashes of it, but I guess from a company perspective, in kayfabe, if you're going to do that, you're not going to show this bit where the guy went off script and did what he was not supposed to do. So it's an interesting balancing act for sure.
The other thing that I really want to shout out is Cena is so good here. He is perfect in his role. And I personally think he's the better performer in this match. He's so... Punk is the guy that's got the rapport with the crowd. He's the guy that everyone is here to see. Cena is the guy making this match work. Cena is the guy that you can tell... He gets more face time, really, from the camera, because, of course, he's the face. And... Mm. He just does a great job with it. You can kind of see how he ended up going into acting. I mean, it's a different element because here he's playing it more subtle, whereas John Cena films are not described as subtle, shall we say. But it's one of those where
clearly you've not seen Fast 10.
I haven't seen any of the Fast films except for 1 and 2.
Just watch the 5th one. That's the best one. Anyway, carry on.
It's great performances. I'd also say, if I want to nitpick, and guess I've been nitpicking all night, so I'll nitpick some more. It's not the worst executed, but you know, it's like you can pick on the execution, but also, as we've said multiple times on this podcast, it doesn't matter if something isn't smooth, because how many matches that I've seen on this that are like got clunky or some execution's not right or it's not right, it doesn't matter, because wrestling at its best is what it makes you feel.
Absolutely. And one of the things we say for a must-see match is, does it work for the crowd in the building on the night?
190%.
Exactly.
Does.
Like if that was the only criteria, like that, this is a yes immediately. Yep. Like they are feeling it.
Yeah, the only reason I wouldn't say must-see is coming back to what Gareth said, in that I think it's must-see for people that were around at this time.
Yeah.
Is it must-see for someone who's never seen it before? Maybe not. The fascinating thing for me, very quickly, is I was looking at the nominations for WWF. We had nearly 180 matches nominated for the history of the WWF / WWE. Two-thirds of them were from the year 2000 onwards. So
that speaks to the age and the nostalgia of our voters, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. Yeah. Like 60 matches up until Armageddon 1999 and 140.
Hopefully not including Armageddon 1999.
And 104. There was one Armageddon 1999 that match nominated. And 114 after. So again, it comes down to this sense of, this is a match for bringing back those memories. But what memories, and what an aura to this match.
Yeah, I think it is difficult to call it must-see as a standalone parachute-in thing. I think it benefits much more if you see the lead-up to it, particularly like the pipe bomb promo. I think that is an essential part of this.
I mean, just the pipe bomb promo and the Go Home Punk promo?
Yeah, but too much Vince. But he is a part of it, I suppose. I wrote Punk is Kikuchi and Sendai to this crowd. That was the last match we watched that had a crowd like this.
Less potato-like.
Yes. I did find the notes that I submitted when I nominated this, and it turns out I pretty much just rewrote them in my notes afterwards. It's two men who aren't especially mechanically gifted but are expert storytellers working as hard as you've ever seen them work. They are trying so hard in this match. I think if WrestleMania was in Chicago, you would have got exactly the same match, but maybe with a tweaked finish that wouldn't be what will happen next on Raw.
Okay.
I think this match is two things. It's the rare occasion that WWE gets wrestling right. It's one of those lightning in a bottle nights that just works for everyone. And as we've talked about a lot at the time, this was super exciting. It's also, unfortunately, a prime example of WWE not being able to get out of their own way. The last 2 weeks of build become more and more McMahon focused, and Cena had to remind us on both the previous Raws that he was the champion and he was the roadblock to Punk's plan. And the final shot of the pay-per-view isn't triumphant CM Punk running through the streets of Chicago with the belt. It isn't despondent John Cena beside himself that he's let everyone down and he's lost his job. It's what will Vince McMahon do now?
And also,
and that's the thing that knocked the corners off this for me.
The bit that I really forgot is how quickly Punk is back, because he's like, what, eight days.
Like
so literally one SmackDown, one Raw, that's all he's off, and then he's back on the following Raw.
Pretty much, yeah, because they do a thing for like a new interim champion, don't they? With Cena ending up facing Rey, and they're with the idea of like SummerSlam is title versus title, isn't it? Interim title versus Punk's title. So it's a Punk Cena rematch that doesn't have the magic of this one. This was 5 stars in the Observer, currently 9.63 on Cage Match. The show as a whole got nothing but thumbs ups in the Observer's post-pay-per-view poll, although 37 people apparently thought the SmackDown Money in the Bank match was better than this.
What the fuck?
All of them with the surname Levesque. In the Wrestling Observer Awards, this was Match of the Year. Punk versus Cena was Feud of the Year. Punk and Cena were second and third, respectively, behind Hiroshi Tanahashi for Wrestler of the Year. Money in the Bank was voted Show of the Year. As I mentioned earlier, Cole, Booker and Lawler took the top three spots for Worst Commentator. Punk was best on interviews and ninth in Most Overrated.
Ooh.
Which was very interesting. Gareth, do you have anything more to add about this before we wrap it up and take it home?
No, I mean, I think one thing we maybe just haven't mentioned, just from the point of view of it being must-see, is, you know, when you talk about it as a match, it's a slice of history, this. It's one of the most important moments in WWE history, and certainly but it certainly when you look at that particular decade. So it's almost must-see on that basis as well, really, that, you know, if you're a newer wrestling fan and you're somebody who's going through, you know, and obviously you can't watch everything because there's so much, it's a key footnote in the history of the business, and it's so influential that it's... there's a lot of negative elements that, you know, fed off the back of this, but there's a lot of highly positive elements that fed off the back of this in terms of fan interaction and what it brought later on.
Yeah.
And then obviously, you know, feeding into the way that certain wrestlers were treated further down the line and things like that. So it's must see on that basis, as well as the actual 33 minutes or so.
Would Daniel Bryan's Mania have happened without this? Almost certainly no.
Yeah, you've brought up something there. Someone in our Discord actually said this is a match and Anglin's story that has done untold damage to pro wrestling. You can draw a straight line from this to Brawl Out. But equally, like people said, this is one of the most magical matches ever, one of my top 10 favorite matches of all time, all of that kind of thing. So, you know, yeah, you're right, it's done good and it's done bad.
It's in the eye of the beholder, isn't it?
It surely is. Yeah. Thank you so much for coming back to join us today. It's been a blast talking to you again. Please feel free to plug your wares, tell people where you can be found on the internet, you want to be found, all of that kind of thing. Talk about Bretro, that's a hell of a show.
Yeah, I think that's the main place you can listen to me now on the Grapple Network. It's very rare that I turn up on Spotlight these days, but yes, me and Matty Edwards, who obviously have long time listeners to this show, will have heard Matty crop up plenty of times on here along the way. We have our Bretro show where we just pick two Bret Hart matches every month and just have a little hours chat in very much the same way that you guys do on here. So yeah, check that out on and you can. If you follow Grapple Pod on Twitter, you can find out when the latest Bretro is out. But also listen to JP and Benno, the Grapple Lads, as they do Spotlight as well. But just would be remiss not to say as well, thanks again for the invite. I had a blast coming on last time, and like you said at the top here, and I couldn't turn this one down. And it's just been great to watch this and have another reason to watch it again, as I'll watch many more times in the future.
Fabulous stuff. As for us, you can go to linktr.ee/mustymatches for all the ways to subscribe, links to the full list of nominations and much more. We are at Musty Matches on Twitter, Instagram, Threads and Blue Sky. We have a Discord, bit.ly/mustymatchesdiscord. I am at Kieran Edits on Twitter, and Mark is
at monkey_buckles.
I must also mention that I have another show every month. Nothing and Like It chronicles the UK's Frontier Wrestling Alliance's adventures on television, including fairly soon the stuff that I made. You can find everything to do with that at linktr.ee/fwapod. Episode 5 is available now. Next week, that doesn't work for me, brother. Bret Hart versus Owen Hart from WrestleMania 10, March 20th, 1994. And joining us will be our final new guest. The king of the DDT, RJ Singh, will be here. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.